A bold new proposal to stem global species loss has been created by one of the world's top experts in ants.
Edward Middle Initial O. Wilson, Honorary Curator of Insects at the Museum at Harvard.
E.O. Wilson, as he's commonly known, has won two Pulitzer Prizes, including one for his book on ants. But the distinguished Harvard biologist has been studying the challenge of species loss for years, focusing on unique habitats that should be conserved to protect the diverse ecological webs within them. Now, in his book, Half Earth, he has done the math. He says we can preserve the bulk of species and ecosystems if we set aside half of the Earth's surface, both land and sea. I spoke with Professor Wilson at his home in Lexington, Massachusetts, and he explained why many ideas for how to tend to nature are, well, misguided.
I'm concerned because those that I like to call the Anthropocenists, that is, those who feel humanity has so thoroughly changed the surface of the Earth and in the seas as well, that we might as well give up. The Anthropocene, carried to an extreme in its conception, is that we've lost the battle in terms of saving natural areas, even in terms of saving most of the biodiversity, the variety of life left on Earth. So we should follow along now in the next stage, either one, to just let it go and proceed to humanize the entire globe. Maybe that was the destiny of the planet. A second version of Anthropocene enthusiasm is, don't worry, the species that have gone extinct, if we keep specimens of them and so on, we'll get their DNA and we'll find out a way to clone them and we'll put them all back eventually and recreate natural ecosystems. All these and similar schemes that have been suggested, relatively the same in my view as running up the white flag as soon as you see the pennants of the enemy appearing on the horizon.
So we can do better, you think?
We better do better. Yes. We can do vastly better. And the conservation movement around the world has been doing everything possible in a conventional worldview with nobility of purpose, with enormous energy and effort and dedication. It has saved a lot of species. But what most people don't realize is that in addition to those beautiful big animals that we so admire and we see many going extinct or up to the brink of extinction, there are literally millions of smaller creatures that are the foundations of our ecosystems, both in the land and the sea, and that they too are probably disappearing at about the same rate. So that we simply are not doing enough of the vertebrates. That's the group we know the best because we know all of these vertebrates. We know the fish, we know the amphibians, we know birds and mammals and reptiles. One-fifth of those vertebrate animals I just listed are sliding down at a pretty rapid rate and going off the cliff to extinction. And of that one-fifth, we're losing, even with our best efforts, 80% or so. We haven't stopped it. We've slowed it, but we haven't stopped it. So we needed something completely different.
And the bottom line, and of course, we're talking about your book, yeah. Half Earth, Our Planet's Fight for Life.
Yes. The book's premise is that what we need to do is try for a moonshot. And the moonshot is to set aside half the surface of the land and half the surface of the sea as a reserve. A reserve that doesn't exclude people by any means. Indigenous people are in fact encouraged to enjoy them and continue their way of life. But if we could give half of the earth primarily to the millions of other species that inhabit the earth with us, then we would be able to save about 80 to 90% of the species, bring the extinction level down to what it was before the coming of humanity. That would be a successful moonshot.
So talk to me with some math about the concept of half Earth. Just how could this work? How would this work?
So where are we right now? And I can tell you that in the United States, we have already put aside about 15% of the land surface. And for the planet as a whole, this is land. We're at about the same. We're about at the 15% mark around the world for the land. And for the sea, it is far less, somewhere around 1% to 3%. And for the United States, it's up toward what it is for the land. It's about 10% of the territorial waters of the United States. So we need to move that on up to about half in order to reach a fairly safe level. Can we do it? Yes, we can do it. Just taking opportunities, gerrymandering small pieces, linking existing parks and small reserves together, we can move the United States up to 50%. I have a notion I call squaring America, North America, including the United States. We start Yukon to Yellowstone. That can be done right now, but let's go on. Yellowstone on down to the Rocky Mountains, and we could easily, well, relatively easy, set up reserves all the way down there as a continuation of the corridor. We get to the Southern Rockies, and then we have to jump over a bit to the Sky Island Mountains of Arizona. If we wanted, then we could continue the corridor, if our Mexican neighbors would like it, in the Sierra Madre Occidental. And we now go back up to the Yukon, and let us think of a great broad corridor across the coniferous forest, the taiga of Canada. Then, reaching the Atlantic coast, let's bring it down through the best forested areas to Maine and over to the still wild areas of Vermont, New Hampshire, through surprisingly open areas that remain in upstate New York until we arrive at the Adirondack. Now we continue the square down onto the southern Appalachians, which reaches into northern Georgia and Alabama. But now comes the Gulf Coast. We'd like to see a corridor from at least far east as Tallahassee, extending along the Gulf Coast, which is biologically the richest part of North America, incidentally, in numbers of species. See it extended on over to Louisiana and eastern Texas. That then, if you think about it, would box America, north, south, east, west, on our square. By the time you pull that off, if you can, you've really added a large amount of natural area.
So what is it about us humans that a majority of people don't share your view, don't understand your urgency, your sense of urgency about this? What is it about us as a species that you think gets in the way? And you write about this some in your book, Half Earth.
I'm afraid it's part of what we call human nature. I believe the reasons why we do so many stupid things, including having constant war and tribal battles and internecine civic strife and conflict between religious faith, we succeeded as a species. You know, we were just one species out of many creatures that looked a little like us anyway, the Australopithecus. And pre-human species, there were quite a few that came into existence and died off. And our stock was the one that got hold of the capacities for language and dividing labors of cooperating groups. We were the one species that got out from Africa. And we did it about 65,000 years ago. And our populations, our ancestral populations, everywhere as they spread, and of course, as they multiplied in Africa itself, they would enter the whole new environments, natural environments. And everywhere they went, they met the pristine environments and they found survival by utilizing everything they could get their hands on in a pristine environment. They began by killing off, in many cases, the native birds and mammals for food. They then cleaned out a lot of the environment with the plant environment by harvesting. They began to develop agriculture. That began about 12,000 years ago. And that meant despoiling the original environment. We survived. We multiplied. We were Darwinian. Those among us who did the most damage to the environment, to our benefit and riches, were typically the ones that got ahead of the competitors in the next area over. And surely that has had an effect on our the evolution of human rapaciousness when it comes to dealing with the environment. That's why it makes it so hard to say, please halt and reconsider before you mow down that rainforest. Please consider leaving enough space on the surface of the earth and the sea for those estimated 10 million other species that exist and which we're wiping out at a rapid rate. We don't know what we're doing, and we're destroying something ineffably beautiful and something the human mind and emotions need, because we still have a deep love of the natural environment in which we evolved. And that included the richness of life and the beauty of open, unspoiled areas.
Why do humans need other creatures? I mean, to what extent are they just nice for us to see, or how vital are they for our survival?
When you start reducing ecosystems by allowing species to go to extinction, then what you are doing is weakening the system as a whole, and then it becomes vulnerable to accelerating change and collapse. We're worried now with good reason about climate change and the fact that we are racing toward almost lethal conditions for life as a whole if we continue on our present path. But what's less recognized is that the same thing exists for biodiversity, for the variety of life that make up the natural ecosystems of the world. We're moving toward a point where the whole thing could begin to unravel with disastrous results for people locally and globally.
So some folks would say, look, why not novel ecosystems, or those that gradually emerge when alien species invade natural ecosystems? They might be good enough.
Oh, you say that so convincingly. I know you're posing the question. Well, we were talking earlier about the Anthropocene, and I told you a stunning fallacy that they engage in. This is the next one. They said, well, you know, all around the world, humans are carrying, whether they intend to or not, these alien species, and they're releasing them. And these are in the worst, most disturbed areas. They're sort of building up little ecosystems of their own. Well, these are highly unstable, and they also include some of the worst pests for humans. And of course, they're very bad for the native species they come in contact with. Novel ecosystems are something to resist and not think of ever as a substitute for the far richer and more stable natural environment. If you want an example of a serious novel ecosystem, go to Hawaii. When you get off the plane and you get your lei around your neck, you will probably not have a single native plant species in there. There'll be species of plants, some of them beautiful, that have taken hold in Hawaii and that can be seen almost any port of call around the tropical world. The birds you see are virtually all going to be introduced birds. So what you're seeing then is a hodgepodge of alien species from all around, and we don't want that to be the condition of the world.
So one of the things you write about in this book is having a Lord God moment. Yeah. As a naturalist. Tell me what you mean by that and your favorite Lord God moments.
Okay. Well, the Lord God moment comes from the southern name for Lord God bird. The ivory-billed woodpecker never was very abundant, so that southerners settling across the south would occasionally see one. And when they first saw one, the second biggest woodpecker in the world, you know, brilliantly colored, well, when they first saw these birds, people often said something like, Lord God, what is that? And that spread enough so that they many often began to call Lord God bird. And what can I say? I have had many Lord God moments, but mostly with ants. One such moment was in the tropical forest when I first saw a swarm of army ants, up to millions in one colony, marching as a broad front, like a conquering army, spreading through the forest floor, capturing everything it could find and kill for their food and then settling back into a heavily guarded bivouac where they lived. That should be a Lord God moment for anybody to see that.
Of course, the ivory-billed woodpecker is gone. You can't find it anymore.
It's gone. And the last one was seen, I think, in the early 1940s by a little boy who knew where a single ivory-billed woodpecker would rest for a while. And he would go out to see it. And then one day that was gone. And all hunts for it have failed. I would give anything to be able to see an ivory-billed woodpecker.
You have a name for the geologic epoch we may be creating here if we continue on the path of destroying habitat and causing species extinction. What is this name, and tell me why you call it that?
Well, you know, about the time of the name Anthropocene, the age of man came in, I suggested that we use the term for this period that we dominate the world as the Eremozoic. Eremo means lonely. And so Eremozoic means the age of loneliness. And for me, kind of the saddest part of all, there would be a heavy weight on the human soul if we really entered it, would be the Eremozoic, age of loneliness, where most of life on Earth that we evolved in, most that you and I are still living in, was gone forever.
And maybe our planet, our species, maybe shouldn't try doing without the rest of the other species, huh?
I think we shouldn't try that. We only have one, I like to call it one Earth, one experiment. We only got one shot at this. Let's be careful.
I know that you're especially optimistic about the role that technology could play in conserving biological diversity. Why do you think the digital revolution is going to help nature rather than make things worse?
You know, the first reaction to thinking about the digital civilization we're moving into so dramatically right now is going to be bad for the natural environment. That's because we think about the digital revolution in the same terms that actually did exist leading up to it. But the digital revolution has qualities to it that are not shared by any means with the first primitive technological industrial revolution. And those qualities all point to a lessened size of what's called the ecological footprint. And everyone, I think, should know what the ecological footprint is because it's critical. The ecological footprint is the amount of area and space, if you wish to make it three-dimensional, required by the average person to maintain for that one person all of the necessities of life. That range from food, from water, from shelter, from entertainment to governance and so on and on and on. And for most of the world, it's 1 to 10 acres. Depending on the country, for America, it's much higher than anybody else. And it's not sustainable. And why would I be optimistic that the digital world is going to shrink that? That is the nature of economic evolution, that people want, and they will select, if they have any choice, instruments and material goods that are smaller, consume less energy and material, need to be fixed less frequently. And all of that means that the ecological footprint is destined to shrink. And if we can now keep our hands off of the natural areas in the world, if we can devise entertainment and fulfillment, making use of all of the accoutrements and monuments of digital age, and develop a conservation ethic, I envision a possible paradise for humanity by the 22nd century.
Paradise for humanity by the 22nd century, and right now we're threatened by climate change, pollution, and loss of species at a precipitate rate.
Well, I know, but now let's think about the United States over a comparable period, you know, its developments as a nation and a society from, say, 1800 to 1900. Humans are making that rate of change. And I believe there's an inevitability of the shrinking of the ecological footprint, not because people know what it is and want to see it shrink, but because of the economic evolution that seems inevitable.
E.O. Wilson's new book is called Half Earth, Our Planet's Fight for Life. Thank you so much, Professor Wilson.
Thank you for the opportunity.